This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hey kids, guess what time it is? This is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and this morning we are here winging our way, or about to board, to our magic carpet. That is Southwest Airlines here in Houston, the early bird flight again, going to Las Vegas for the Magic Collector Expo in Las Vegas, and it's going to be a lot of fun. We've got a couple of activities here this evening on Thursday, but most of the activities all day Monday are back-to-back tours for the David Copperfield Museum, and that's going to be personally guided by several people, including David himself. So that'll be a lot of fun with some other activities later in the evening. And so anyhow, I have a lot of friends who are attending, as I know you do as well. And you, if you're not there, you would like to hear what's going on, be glad to share that with you on this podcast. So if there's somebody you want me to go and seek out and talk to, let me know, and I will do that. You can just drop me an email, scott@themagicwordpodcast.com, or you can text me. Many of you have my number, and I'd be glad to try and seek out that person and ask whatever question you might have. So try to make this a little bit more interactive than I have with some of the other conventions. But this is only going to be a couple of days worth of updates. So this one you're hearing then right now will be for Thursday and Friday, and then the second and final day will be on Saturday. I am going to stick around for a little bit longer and see a few shows with my buddy Murray Sawchuk and James DeMare and Banachek and Fielding West and just a lot of other guys. So going to be sticking around having some fun, and I'm going to be soon in Las Vegas, and we will talk with you on the other side. Oh, you know, I know what you're wanting to know. Yeah, this Dunkin' Donuts coffee is hot. Just a second here. Yeah, that's hot coffee. And more importantly, you want to know probably what kind of donuts I've got here today. All right, well, it appears I forgot. I always get the chocolate. I really like chocolate. And then I got chocolate Boston cream. So there we go. Those I only got two here today instead of three. Yeah, I'm cutting back. Yeah, along with my exercise. So that kind of offsets, what, 20 miles of running? Anyhow, I'm going to enjoy that while I get ready to board the plane here very shortly. And winging my way, as I said, to Las Vegas. And we'll see you there. For the Magic Word Podcast, this is Scotty out. Hello, Las Vegas. We are here. We've arrived at the Orleans, and interesting fact is everyone must be masked. That is, everyone who is down gambling or whether you are in the hotel, unless you are eating or drinking something, you have to be masked even in between. So everyone is masked for this whole thing, which is going to be kind of interesting. And I haven't attended one quite like that, but at least they haven't asked us if we have been vaccinated, although I brought proof of vaccination if you had to do that somewhere. But anyhow, so I've arrived in Vegas and had a lot of fun already. Just as I was starting to get my rental car, I got a phone call from Fielding West. He said, hey, let's get together for lunch. So I just finished with lunch, came over to the Orleans, checked in. First person I saw is going to be the first one up today with an interesting lecture about Siegfried and Roy, and that is Paul Stone. Hello, Paul.
Hey, how you doing, Scott?
I am fantastic and so glad to see you, my friend, because you are the guy who is kind of the entrepreneur and the impresario who puts a lot of things together. You have put together a lot of conventions and things here in Vegas, as well as other kinds of things worldwide. What was the name of the thing you used to do that was here? You had Jeff Hobson.
Vegas Magic Theater was one of them, which we did at the Gold Coast for 6 months. But I also did loads of shows, Variety Live, and we had World Stars of Magic.
Yeah,
plenty of different shows. Incidentally, I've got to ask you. I bet you paid for lunch with Fielding, correct?
I did.
Yeah, I thought you might. Anyway, sorry.
You're a mind reader too. Well, he's a buddy. I feel like I owe him.
He's a good man. He's one of my best friends as well.
But he picked up the tip.
Well, picked up and walked away with it.
I was also talking about, though, a magic convention that you had put together. What was the name of the convention? I said it had Jeff Hobson in there.
Oh, the Intervention.
We did
two of them here in town, which was great. Yeah, we had, that was where the first one, where Teller did his Red Bull lecture, which the only time he's ever done it.
The Red Bull lecture?
The Red Bull, the trick he does in his show, which has never been seen anywhere else.
And he performed it or explained it?
Both, actually. Okay. But I think when he explained it, he didn't tell us everything. Of course he didn't.
No, I'll hold a little bit back over there. So have you attended many of these collectors? Did you used to go to the L.A. Conference on History?
No, I have to be honest with you. It's a first for me, but I'm happy to be here. No, I'm not really a collector. It's just I've been around so many years. I sort of accumulate a lot of stuff, you
we
know?
We have become collectors by virtue of just age.
And that's exactly right.
Hanging around long enough.
Yeah.
So, but you also have become associated, I know, with Siegfried and Roy, and close with them. That was back during a time, I guess, when they still were having the Las Vegas show.
Desert Magic Seminar.
Desert Magic Seminar, yeah.
I used to be the European advisor for that, so I brought all that talent in for years, all the people from, you name it, from Moretti's and Tamaris and Paul Daniels and Salvano and Richard Ross, all those guys, you know, going back. So, yeah, a long time ago, but they were great events, yeah.
Yeah, back in the early 80s. The one I remember, I did attend, and it was supposed to be the one that had... my mind just went blank. Fred Capps was supposed to have come, and I think it was his later stages of cancer and couldn't come, and so I never got a chance to see him perform.
Oh, really? I was funny enough. I was just talking to someone yesterday because I knew Fred because of Ken Brook, obviously my association with Ken, and spent a lot of time with Fred Capps and was involved with a couple of his shows, including the one that John Fisher put on, which was a really fantastic one with Ricciardi Jr., Ricky Jay, and Fred Capps. And unbelievable. Yeah, unbelievable.
Did you ever work with John Fisher on his television shows? Yeah. I mean, the regular
star. To me, that was the greatest ever TV series, The Best of Magic. And I was the magic consultant on the whole of the first series, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Yeah.
So, did you work with Ali Bongo, or was he involved with that?
Yeah, Ali was involved, but it was when Arturo Brichetti really first came on the scene, and Jeffrey Durham and stuff. But I mean, The Best of Magic you can imagine, there was John Fisher and Charlie Reynolds were the two guys who put it together, and mm-hmm. it was a whole different.
Didn't they have like about 12 or 15 episodes or something?
They did two series of it, but I mean, there was anyone who was anybody was on that show, and it was fantastic.
I think that's available on DVD someplace.
Quite possibly, and also I'm going to give it a plug because he's just come out. John's just written a book called Heroes of Magic, which you'll see, which Gabe has produced, which is phenomenal.
Gabe Fiore from Potter and Potter.
Absolutely fantastic. It's just, I think he's got a few here actually, but it is phenomenal. All John's books are great, but this is a fantastic one which mentions everybody you're talking about, like Fred Capps and Siegfried and Roy and everybody. Brilliant.
So your talk today is going to be about Siegfried and Roy. Can you give us a little tip on that?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you. Basically, in 2008, I was in England at the time, and I produced the IBM British Ring Convention, and I always used to do a charity show at the London Palladium. I did a number of those shows, and I did a variety show, and I just thought it would be really nice to maybe dedicate it to Siegfried and Roy. Particularly, it was a few years after the accident, no one really had seen or heard of them.
Right.
Anyway, it turned out that I, in the end, decided to make it a tribute to them. Then I thought, well, maybe if we make a presentation, we might even possibly get Siegfried over. I knew we wouldn't get Roy over, but I thought it was a chance. Anyway, cut a long story short, thanks to Lynette Chappell, who was their leading lady in The Evil Queen, we managed, with a lot of persuasion and a lot of help from her, not only to get Siegfried to come over to London, but also Roy. And it was fantastic because it was an opportunity for people to say goodbye and say thank you to Siegfried and Roy from all over the world. People came into the London Palladium, which is the home of variety, 2,500 people, sell-out event, lots of celebrities, Dame Shirley Bassey, Anthony Hopkins. We had all sorts, and we had 10 of the greatest acts that came in for it. And obviously, then French TV filmed it. It was just a very, very special show. So, I have got some great footage from that. I've got some interviews as well with Norm. It was Norm Nielsen's. It was his last show. He came out of retirement. He rehearsed for 3 months just to do that show, and then he retired. And then it was Johnny's last time that Johnny and Pam worked with a live, about 12-piece live orchestra, which Johnny wrote the charts for. So he literally was like going to heaven for him, and he was fantastic. So today I'm going to show some clips of the show, of the performers, and a couple of Johnny and Norm of their act, but also which was filmed brilliantly because they had a 10-camera shoot, so some of the shots are brilliant. It's fantastic footage. But also I did some interviews about 3 or 4 years later, just with Norm and with Johnny and with Siegfried, asking about what they felt about the show, and that's just priceless footage. So I'm going to show that today. I mean, I haven't got a lot of time, unfortunately. I've got half an hour to show this, but I'm going to show as many pictures, as many video clips as possible.
Wow, you're going to be cramming a lot into that 1 hour.
I'm going to talk a lot less than I'm talking now and just show as many photos and videos as I can.
Hopefully, as you're showing photos, that can run the background as you're maybe talking about some of these things.
Yeah, I don't really need to talk too much about it because I'm just going to link it, to be honest with you. I'm going to give some background to the show quickly and then let the thing do it. You'll see.
For those who are listening who won't have the opportunity to see this, will they ever get to see it like on a DVD release?
So you know, I mean, again, it depends if they're quick, but earlier in the year, I released a limited edition collector's box set from that show, which had had all sorts of memorabilia programs, all sorts of stuff, including a flash drive, which was an engraved flash drive, a gold key, which on it has the whole French TV show, all sorts of footage from the show, all the interviews, Johnny's whole act, Norm's whole act, everything. It's all on there. And I think we sold most of them, but we still have, there was only 175 of them, but they're still available. They're still available to buy. In fact, it's something, well, if they're not here, they won't get them, but you can go online and get them. I think it's the website is srpalladiumtribute.com, and you'll see all the details about it. But there's only a few of those left, but that's on that flash drive. It's got everything, including some great footage.
Wow. I don't have to ask you any questions. You answered everything. I was going to ask you about that, about where to find those and everything. So it's great that those are still, at least a few are still available.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, anyway, so yeah, that would be that. So I'm hoping today that people will enjoy at least seeing, I mean, to be honest with you, it's a bit of a going down memory lane, not just for Siegfried and Roy, but also for Johnny and Pam. Obviously, sadly, Pam's no longer with us either, and Norm. And it's great to see them work and to hear them talk.
And what a great kickoff also then, Paul, because this is going to be Las Vegas. We are in Las Vegas, and they are epitomized.
They're iconic. They are Las Vegas. I mean, they almost reinvented Las Vegas, didn't
exactly.
they? You know, so no, it's great. So I'm happy to do it, and they were great people and great friends, and we miss them all of them.
Yeah, we do. Great to open with that, and it's great to have my first conversation then with you, Ben. Paul, it's great catching
nice
up with
to
you.
See you again, Scott. You take care.
All right. So for the Magic Grid Podcast, that was Paul Stone. Scotty out. Before we go into the dealer's room, I thought I'd have an opportunity to speak with someone else who is a well-known collector, and he was just showing me something he picked up from the Doug Henning family. And when I say Doug Henning, the next name that should come to mind is Chip Romero. Hello, Chip.
Oh, that's nice. Thank you, Scott Wells. Thank you, sir. That's very nice to say. Thank you.
And he is speaking to you through his mask, so if it sounds muffled, there's a reason. It's not because of my windscreen or anything.
We are here in our mask, but the rest of us, we're naked.
Visualize that.
We are naked, but we have our mask, and don't you worry about a thing. We're just good friends.
Are you going to be on the bill talking about Henning this during the convention?
No. I am merely a registrant because I know all these people, and it was really. You must admit already, this is a mini Magic Live, and it's all my friends.
Yeah.
So it's the other 1,000 people that I never knew at Magic Live. It's the 200 people I do know. It's like they're all here.
Yeah, that's true.
And it was the only thing that got me out of my home. I have not left my home anywhere since January I went to the SAM here, and I have not left since. But you start talking about a bunch of collectors and Copperfield's collection, and, well, that gets my little tail right out of the house real quick.
So show us what it is you got right here. What is this?
I'm sharing this with a few people. I have not even gone through the entire thing myself. I'm only going to read you like 3 lines or 4 lines, and what I have is the actual little book or the little spiral notebook that you would put in your front shirt pocket, and it says, "Life is potluck. Bingo. Bingo. Who knows what awaits me? Who cares?" And I'm just going to stop there, and this is the little spiral notebook that Doug carried in his left front shirt pocket. And it's when he was from Oakville, Ontario. And this would have been the time that he was going back and forth on the bus in L.A. He had no money at all. And he was there in L.A. to meet Di Vernon. That's exactly when this would have been, pre, like, 71, 72. And it is his diary. And I have brought it here to show Mike Caveney and a few people, and also Gabe Fahuri. And what we're going to do is I'm going to ask them for their detective skills, because I want to be cool like those guys. And so I brought this for Mike and Gabe. And we're going to look at it together, and we're going to look at Doug's diary when he was just like us before the magic show, before anything. This is when Doug was just like us.
What year would this have been approximately?
Like 71, 72.
And so we believe also, or you believe this, there was a map of how to get to the Magic Castle.
Right. Oh, yes. So, okay, since you brought that up, yes, I just showed you that. And there is a small little diagram in here. And there is absolutely no doubt that is from Hollywood Boulevard up Franklin to the castle. There's no doubt. I mean, if you could see the picture, it's purely a map that's made, the walking map. And the reason I know that's because I've walked this exact same route myself when I worked the Magic Castle.
Can I take a picture of that and post that on? Yes or no?
That's the one thing you can do. That's the one thing, and then that's it. So yes, we'll give you a picture of that.
Okay.
But it's not beautiful, and it's not going to be relevant unless they listen to this.
Exactly. But for people who do listen, then you can go to the website and you can see
and
this.
And this is in Doug's hand in his notebook, and it says Los Angeles, and that's when he was writing his thoughts in Los Angeles.
Right. So. Well, Chip, thanks very much. I'm glad you're here, and always good to see you, buddy, since it's been way too long just to get to talk to you on the phone to actually see you face-to-face. And not getting a hug yet, but we're getting close.
I'm hugging everybody. I don't give a damn.
Okay. Even though you're wearing the mask.
I'm hugging. I don't care. Okay. We're wearing our masks. We're doing what we're supposed to
do. We'll hug it out here in a minute.
This is the time. This is the time. You know what? It's what we got to do. And at least we're here together having fun.
There we go. So. Thanks again. Thank you. So for the Magic Word Podcast, we are just getting started, and this is a lot of fun. That was Chip Romero. This is Scotty out. So we went in the dealer room, and I haven't gotten very far. Just got to Dan Summers' booth, and he is the one, of course, who is the one authorized to make Walter Blaney's levitation, his ladder levitation, as well as the new thing is the vanishing birdcage, which is an amazing thing. And I want to talk here with Blair Rosenbluth, who is...
Blair Robertson.
Keep going. And so now we're going to talk with Blair Robertson, who is the one who actually had written part of the book about this, and he is thinks it's one of the best tricks he's ever purchased. And so, Blair, hey, good to meet you.
Very nice.
It's time to actually meet you personally.
It's an honor to meet you, a legend in the making. I feel fantastic. I, the only thing I'm feeling bad about is I don't have a martini here. So,
well, we still got about an hour before martini time down at the alligator bar. We'll see what
sounds good to me. Sounds good to me.
So, but as we were talking, you were saying when you came across this was the best magic trick ever you have purchased.
John Booth, I forget which book it is, John Booth, famous Canadian magician. I'm a Canadian as well. He was talking to a bunch of famous New York magicians, and they were talking, what's the best magic trick ever? And they all unanimously said the vanishing birdcage. And Walter and I spoke about that, and I fully agree. Because a lot of times when we're talking as magicians, we're looking at it from our perspective. Mm-hmm. What do magicians do? When a magician performs, when you ask a person on the street, what does a magician do? They make things appear, they make things disappear. So if you're in a bar and somebody says, oh, I saw this magician, what did he do? Well, he reached around behind his back, pulled out a bird cage with a bird in it. Was the bird real? No, it was not a real bird, but it was a big bird. And he made it vanish instantaneously right in front of my eyes. It's the perfect trick because it's visual. It's something that you can hold onto the cage and it can still disappear. But more importantly, it's something that people can easily understand and explain. It's by far the best magic trick, in my personal opinion, as well as other famous people as well. It's the best trick. I've never gotten a stronger reaction than I have with the vanishing birdcage.
And you've done a lot of research on this and knowing all the Lyndhurst cage and the other people who have used this down through time and have seen the variations. And so you know the hardships that Walter had gone through in order to make this perfect vanishing birdcage. And so can you talk about that just a bit?
I can absolutely talk about that. One of the things that about the vanishing birdcage is this one that Daniel and the Blaney family authorized was in Canadian millimeters away from not coming into existence, because all the bird cages that are out there, including a famous one that I won't mention that everybody talks about, are built wrong. They're built in a way that they can't vanish in the proper method. Walter had an idea for the perfect vanishing birdcage and spent tens of thousands of dollars and years trying to get it built to his specifications, and unfortunately failed upon his death. Daniel Summers came up with the perfect solution and therefore has honored his memory and with the blessing of the Blaney family has come out with literally the perfect vanishing birdcage. It vanishes at about Mach 5.
Yeah. That's very good. And you do a very good job of it as well, even fooling David Copperfield up close.
I don't know if I fooled him, but
he
knew what to look for. It's you can't fool a legend like David Copperfield, but... when he said do it again, I thought, well, that's pretty awesome. That was, I was nervous as hell because he's a legend. But at the same time, it was really interesting to be able to... He was very gracious. Asked me to do it again. That's quite the honor from a guy of his caliber. So.
Right. Well, one of the reasons I wanted just to bring this up is because last week when we were in Colon, we were at the gravesite for Walter Blaney, and Lance Burton had performed this as an homage to Walter, and I'd recorded that. So if you go back to the website, you can see a video. It's on YouTube, by the way, and it's already gotten, I don't know how many, a lot of hits already, people watching that. And so, because he has his own way of performing it then as well, which is a little bit slower.
Yeah, well, there's the that comes from Billy McComb, and Billy McComb came up with the concept of the slow motion cage. Some people like it, some people don't. I think if anybody doing it, Lance Burton is a master. There's no getting around that. My personal preference is to have it visually disappear right in front. Yeah, Walter's way. So that's not a slam on Billy McCombe. That's not a slam on Lance. They're masters at that. And it was amazing to see Lance do it at the funeral because the wind was blowing, so he really couldn't even fully do it sort of the proper way, yet the Blaney cage, which he used, allowed him to get away with it in a beautiful and amazing manner.
And a nice little thing also that Daniel is selling now is the spyglass also, which is part of Walter's routine.
Yes.
Whenever he has the ladies put their hands on it, and then the lady with the ring, and he says, ooh, look at that. You can almost see that from the moon. He pulls out this long spyglass to look at that. So,
yeah, well, I was talking to him about that. I actually searched around to find I hope Daniel doesn't mind, but I'm going to take a little bit of credit for that. I bought a whole pile of them, and I found a perfect one, and I let him know about it. So because that's the Vanishing Birdcage, as miraculous as it is, it made Walter famous. He used to get bookings with it. He would do cold calls and vanish it. And I mean,
he told me when he was in buildings in downtown Houston, he would go from in an office building to be so many different companies, and he would go from room to room and office to office, floor to floor, and he would do that over and over.
You can. And so the eyeglass is just one other little funny bit of his that he added to make it into a huge entertainment piece. Yeah. But I think the most important thing about Walter and the part that's in my opinion, is he came up with brilliant things, the silver hoop, he came up with the levitation. But this truly is his masterpiece in my eyes. Yeah. I'm not saying his other stuff was not good. It was phenomenal. But this is like the masterpiece. And some people will argue and say, well, $2,500 is a lot of money for this cage. You're not just getting the cage. You're getting the cage, 70 years of research and development into it. A perfect routine that just can't be beat. A cage that, if you work it and practice it, will build you a reputation. And it's priced accordingly. You're not going to get the ladder levitation cheap. You're not going to get this. But you'll have something that they'll make a reputation for anybody.
Well, very cool. Well, now you're starting to sound like a dealer.
Well, no, I'm not.
The dealers are,
you can edit that part out if you, but I can't help it. Leave that in because if it does sound like I'm selling it, it's because the cage I had before this one was an old Lindhorse, and it didn't vanish as well as this one does. Mm-hmm. This has renewed my spirit for this. It's an effect that people talk about. And if you're listening to this, or if I'm ever at a magic convention again, if they'll allow me back in, I've got the cage with me in my back pocket at all times.
All the time, just like Walter did.
You bet.
Thank you, Blair, very much.
Nice to talk to you. It's really great to meet you, and you got a great podcast. I love listening to your stuff. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. It was Blair Underwood for...
Robertson.
That was Blair Robertson from the Magic Word Podcast. Scotty out. So we're back in the dealer's room, and it's actually day two, and this is kind of the first full day, but not really a full day. It's all been tours today of the Copperfield Museum. We'll talk to some people who have been at the museum. But I'm over here at H&R Magic Books, and I've got Paul Keeve and also Richard Hatch who are with me. Hey there, Paul.
Good afternoon, Scott.
And Richard.
Hey, Scott. Good to see you.
Good seeing you, buddy. So let me just first of all say, Paul, I really enjoyed what you had to present. It was during the sawing thing that the Magic Circle Unlocked did with the Robert Harbin thing and everything. And did you work a little bit at all with Mike Caveney on his book, on some of the research on that? Or
to be honest, I didn't. I mean, Mike's been interested in sawing for as long as Mike's been around, I think.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
And no, I didn't. I mean, I watched with fascination his accumulation of materials over the years, and I have very fond memories of the Sawing in Half show that was presented at Magic Live. So I loved that show. It was all the different versions of Sawing in Half, including David Charvet doing the Blackstone, the Pendragons doing Clearly Impossible, the I think it was Caelan and Ginger did the Wakeley.
Yeah,
so it was great to see it come alive in a book. No, the only thing I sent Mike some cartoons from an old comic book, which showed the sawing and the secret, but I think that was after he was working on the book. So, no, Mike's been, he is the world expert on that, and I love the fact that all those twists and turns in the story, are now in print.
Right.
And I was saying to him, it's an interesting point, and I think that the British magic scene is as guilty as this is the American, is the almost like imperialization of ideas, like the idea that Zati Sungar actually came up with the thin sawing, but it was sort of kind of ended up being credited to, you know, American inventors, and that's happened with English performers as well. They sort of took things from Indian touring magicians, and that's a whole other history that's kind of buried within it, and I think that's really fascinating.
Yeah, it is. And also fascinating, I thought, was your association with Bob Harbin. You had known Bob, I guess, as you were growing up through the Magic Circle, and some of the things that you had collected and fallen heir to were pretty incredible you were showing here as well.
Thank you. Well, I never actually met Bob Harbin.
Oh.
No, I was he died in 1978 when I was 11, but I was just completely fascinated by Zig Zag from the photograph in Milbourne Christopher's Illustrated History of Magic, which showed Mark Wilson performing it with Bobo the Clown leaning through the middle. So as a kid, I just wanted to build a zigzag. I wasn't quite sure how it worked, but I made it out of cardboard boxes from the supermarket. And I put my younger brother in it, and all the boxes kind of collapsed, and I got very annoyed with him.
What did you use for blades?
Oh, I don't think I got that far. I think the box collapsed. But then I found out many years later that, remarkably, David Mendoza, the illusion builder, the first thing he built was a zigzag out of cardboard boxes.
Wow.
So we shared that experience. But he told me that his was only ever meant to be a prototype, or I was pretty serious that mine was going to be used in performance.
Okay.
I eventually made one that worked, but it was made out of matchboxes. And then I did build one as well, but that's a whole other story. But I just got fascinated with zigzag, and I think it's an illusion that, As I often say now, it's like if it was done by Picasso or by a surrealist, it would be considered to be a surreal effect. Because whereas if you compare, for example, the P.T. Selbit sawing through a woman, there is no illusion there until the very end when you separate the box and the woman is not dead.
Yeah.
But with the zigzag, the whole idea is surreal. You know, there's nothing that you couldn't really do that even if you had blades. So the whole thing is a kind of surreal fantasy, really. It's like the idea that a lady can stand in a box smiling. And I did a lot of research into zigzag for the Harbin centenary. And I was really struck by the fact it was modern in so many ways. And one of them is that the assistant, if you like, is completely central to the presentation. She's not actually passive in that. And Gay Blackstone talked about the fact that she, you know, when she's in the zigzag, she's an equal performer. And also, when I was researching it, I realised that there were no better people to ask about the effect of the zigzag than the assistants, because they're staring straight out at the audience.
And they have a lot of good stories if you ask them. Yeah.
And it was interesting. I was talking to Diane Zimmerman this morning, who was actually the first Harbin zigzag lady in America.
Oh, wow.
And she was telling me the story of how Bob Harbin set up the prop. And she thought it wasn't even going to work because it was so badly made compared to the beautiful Owens zigzag. And it was all bits of string holding the doors on.
Wow.
As the catches and cloth hinges. And it was very cobbled together. And, of course, we have the zigzag, the original zigzag in the Magic Circle Museum in London.
Right.
And it's quite an amazing thing.
I have seen that. There's so many things I like to unpack on this, and we should do a whole podcast and record sometime in the future, and I'll call you. And I'm going to ask you about how you got over here from England, by the way, too. Have you been here for a while, or how did you get over from...
I have been here for a little while, but I had to... I think I'm the only visiting Brit here at the convention. I had to come via... I came via Mexico for 2 weeks, because it's not that we're barred from coming in. It's that you're not allowed to have been in Europe for the previous 14 days. I should say Europe and the UK, because unfortunately now, of course, we're no longer in Europe, regretfully. So I had to go into Mexico for 2 weeks, and I had to keep all the documentation that I'd been in Mexico for 2 weeks. And I came through customs in America slightly nervously, wondering if all my baggage tags and hotel receipts and passport stamp would be enough. And they didn't even ask me. So I probably could have flown straight in, but
better to be prepared.
Yeah, but no, that's how I'm here. and I'm very happy to be here.
So I was going to ask you about the matchboxes. Dick, I'm coming to you in just a minute over here. This is fascinating.
Happy to listen.
About the matchboxes, did you make it so it's matchbox size, so it's like the first Zig-Zag cigarette that you did before Tenyo, or was it matchbox, like, large for a person, or what did you do with it?
No, I had a magic kit. It was called the Magic Game. Magic Game, in fact. And it had a little plastic doll in it that you sawed in half. Yeah. And I took that doll and I made the Zig-Zag for the size of the doll. My matchbox Zig-Zag, which I found quite recently in a shoebox, it was complete with sliding panel and blades. But I've lost the blades. But
you use razor blades, I guess.
I could have used razor blades. No, it was little cardboard blades that I made. And I did make it with the sliding panel and all the painting on it.
Wow.
So I think I discovered quite a bit about it. There's actually a wonderful little story about the Zig-Zag, which I recalled to Diane this morning. And apparently when one of Harbin's first performances, he performed the Zig-Zag, and then he bumped into Alan Allen. Now, you may not know Alan Allen as well over here, but Alan Allen was pretty straight down the line.
Escape.
He was the first guy to escape from a burning robe in a straitjacket. And he ran a shop in London called Alan Allen's Magic Spot. And he was always very abrupt. He was fairly straight to the point with his opinions. So Bob Harbin bumps into Alan Allen after one of the performances. And Alan says, "Oh, I like that new illusion you did." And Harbin said, "Oh, I'm glad you liked it. Did you have any idea how it was done?" He said, "Well, it must be something to do with the paintwork, because it's the only prop of yours I've seen that's been painted well."
That's funny. Dick, so I was going to ask you then also, you, I guess, have been coming to these collectors' workshops or collectors' meetings for a long time. Did you used to go to the LA conference in Magic also?
I did. I've been to all but the first one, and I regret not having been at that one, but I've enjoyed them all, and I'm sorry that they are on possibly permanent hiatus. I hope they bring them up again, because that was my favorite conference ever. They always had fascinating stuff, great speakers, people that you'd look at the title of their talk and say, "Oh, that's not going to be too interesting," and it would be fabulous, fantastic, and people you'd never heard of.
I never attended, but the one I'd heard about, of course, was when John Gaughan performed the one with the
The Hooker card.
Yeah. That was a high point in my Magic experience life. It was just unbelievable. And he did it twice, and the second time was not as good, not because he didn't do it as well, but just that initial shock isn't there anymore of having no clue. You know, for the second time, I've had a chance to think about it and eliminate some things. And it was great the second time. But for me as an experience, the first time was really a magical high point. I think the first year they did also the Keller Levitation, and I never got to see that, and that would have been great too. But every year they did special stuff, both performances, things you'd never see anywhere else. The Million Dollar Mystery, Mike Caven did that, fabulous. Just, again, a total fooler. Yeah, they were wonderful, so I miss them. This is kind of taken over from the Magic Collectors Association. Used to have an annual event, traditionally in Chicago.
Right.
Then it started to move around. They had one in Appleton, they had one in Baltimore, one in Washington, D.C. There was one in Las Vegas here. But they haven't done it for a couple of years. They're still putting out their magazine, Magical, on an irregular schedule. David Benn and Julie Yang of Magicana are doing a great job putting it out. Great content. But there haven't been annual meetings. And so David Sandy and Bill Smith decided, I guess, 2 years ago to do one in Minneapolis, and that was sufficiently successful that Bill Smith decided to do one where he lives here in Las Vegas. And I understand next year is going to be in your backyard in Austin. I'm looking very much forward to that.
Right. That's going to be fun.
Yeah.
It's going to be great, and I'm glad that you're going to be able to join us. And so that's interesting to kind of tell the history of how that has evolved then over the years then, too.
Now, in Florida, blanking on the guy's name, but there is one that's scheduled for September. I'm not going. It's the exact same weekend.
This is different from the Yankee Gathering also, which is completely different.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a... Gosh, I'm blanking on the guy's name. You'd know him. He's a cruise ship worker, at least that's how I think. Dan Stapleton. Yeah, he's doing one. And it's the same weekend as the Magi Fest in Columbus, Ohio, which Charlie and I always go to.
I'll see you there. I'll be there.
So it's unfortunate that, you know, we can't do them all, but that one should be good, too. Looks like they've got a good...
So did you get a chance to go to Copperfield Museum this morning? And let me have your thoughts on that.
Wow.
Paul?
I did go, yes.
But he had been there before, which I hadn't.
Yeah.
So for me, it was... I mean, I had high expectations, but they were actually exceeded. I had no idea about how everything was organized. And, you know, seeing our friend Walter Blaney has his own... space there. Of course, you'd been there for when that was dedicated. I don't know if it's changed at all since then, but he's got Blaney and Cardini and Channing Pollock that all have their own shrines, if you will.
What was your most memorable part of the tour?
Gosh. I don't know if there's something that jumps out at me as saying, wow, that's a once-in-a-lifetime thing. It's, there's so much there. My takeaway is like, hey, I gotta find a way to come back.
And spend some more time.
Yeah, exactly. It'd be nice to spend a week in town and go there every day to do some research or something, if you could.
Yeah. Well, I'm kind of like with Paul. I had an opportunity then also after Johnny Thompson's service to go over there and spend about 4 hours, and David and Chris showing us through and getting to spend a lot of quality time and getting to see everything, you know, back behind there. But I thought the fact that each person was showing something like their specialty, so starting off with David Copperfield and showing the tannins, shop, and then handing that off over then to was it Stan Allen? No, to Jim Rollins, and then on to Stan Allen, and Charles Green, everybody. It was just really great.
Yeah, they were all appropriately chosen people to talk us through it. It was good. Well done.
And Paul, since you've already experienced this before, also, what were your thoughts having seen it through a little bit different kind of a tour here?
Well, I thought, and I'm fortunate to be friends with David, and I've spent many, many days there, actually, at the museum. And I know, for example, that I've been in there and just taken one of those brown folders off the shelf and spent several hours just looking at one thing and still not having really properly absorbed it. So it was very interesting to go through again and see the whole thing at once. And it's always overwhelming because you just can't possibly really take it in.
No. This was like Copperfield Museum light. Everybody got to see the overview.
But I think it was wonderful to see people's reactions, for the first time. And also it was really interesting to see, because I think today was a historic day for the museum, because they've never done that many people through it. And I hope in a way it's a pilot, to see if they can do more, tours in the future, because of course that place is set up now, it's never going to be a normal museum, but it is set up to be seen and to be experienced. And that was very exciting to see everybody go through. And I think the other thing I'd say about it, as you said, Scott, I think it was really wonderful and brilliantly efficiently done, and from David introducing everybody and doing that wonderful performance in the Tannen's room, and talking about his origins in magic and his theatricality to go into a dark room and him perform the first counter from Macy's, and then the lights go up with the music, and people really did have an intake of breath, and quite a few people with tears in their eyes, I could see, because that experience of walking into a magic shop as a kid is often what started us in magic. And I think that's always been David's brilliance, is to take a feeling and make you experience it, and he's now doing that on the tour. So it was, I've experienced that before myself. I didn't grow up in the US, so obviously I did go to Tannen's when I was 20, but I think for a lot of people there,
Davenport's, I guess,
yeah Davenport's, exactly. And it is that wonderful thing, and I think that's one of the gifts of his work as a performer, is to give people emotion, and he does that even on the tour.
With the music and lighting.
Yeah, and it's wonderful, and I love the way that he invests fully in that, he commits, and with the lighting and the music, and in a way it's quite surprising, because he's talking fairly casually, and then suddenly this music comes up, and the lights go, and that was a wonderful moment, but overwhelming, and the amount of knowledge in that room of the presenters, I've never seen that before. Very often you walk in, and I've been fortunate to look around the poster room. I've even sometimes been fortunate to pick something out and show it to David and say, oh, you know what this is. And he's always interested if anyone sees things and they've got a backstory. It's always worth contacting one of the team and letting them know, because with anything of that number of artifacts, there are people that go around that will know something about individual objects.
Right.
And I think that, that's one of the things, is the more when people see things, it's a bit like when you research something, you end up learning more about it because people tell you about it.
Right.
When I did my Harbin talk, loads of people told me about Harbin, and it's like that story about Alan Alla, that some wonderful performance stories.
Right.
So I think, if people see things and they go, oh, I know something about that, or it's always worth feeding it back in. I think it's Eddie Dawes has a rule, I think he calls it the 3 C's of collecting, and it's collect, collate, communicate. And that's really what it is. It's not really, to me, it's not about collecting. It's about the history of the object and the stories of the objects. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the tour starts, with the Macy's counter. Mm-hmm. And you suddenly, in a way, it's the ultimate magic, because you see this counter that you've been watching him do the trick on, and then by the end of it he says, and this is the actual counter that I stood in front of, and this is where I started my love of magic.
Yeah.
And it feels quite, you know, it's a spine-tingling moment, because it really is, because everyone has had a moment they started in magic, wherever that, they may not have been in front of a counter, for a lot of people it was. So I think it's a wonderful thing, and, you know, obviously there's a lot of English stuff in there. I'm honoured to say that I suggested the Masculinity Cook section, which I think is expanding, the posters. Probably means I'll never be able to get another Masculine and Cook poster now. But no, it's wonderful to see it there. And, you know, Leslie Cole's collection, as anyone would have said at the time, Leslie Cole was a hoarder, as Mike Haveney was saying yesterday, and he collected all these things in carrier bags and left them in piles in his house. And, of course, it was here under a tarpaulin for 24 years. I personally had a go at David a few times ago. When are you going to unpack that? And when he's unpacked it in style. And now it's seen in a way that it was never seen at Leslie Cole's.
So by more people, too.
Yeah, and by more people. I mean, I have a slight mixed thing about a lot of the English stuff being here, but we don't have anything equivalent. We don't have the resources, say, at the Magic Circle Museum, which has got a wonderful collection.
Right, right.
But, you know, to have the space here, see it in that incredible display is always very moving, and always feel lucky to see it.
Great. Good feedback from both you guys. Thank you very much.
Okay,
that was good.
Now.
Okay, well, and I'm going to move on. Thank you very much, Paul Keith, and also thank you, Dick Hatch. And we'll talk to you guys later for the Magic Word Podcast. Okay. Scotty out. So now I thought you might like to hear just a few other comments from people who have attended the museum. It was just, I'm not going to put words into his mouth. Terry Magelson is the one who's going to tell us from Kansas City right now. Terry, tell me, what are your thoughts about attending the museum?
Well, I've waited for this day. This was like a journey to Mecca. Other people described it as definitely heaven for magicians. The first thing I want to say is I am so glad that somebody like David Copperfield has the resources to do this, has done it. Magicians can rest assured knowing that the history of magic is well preserved, probably forever, in this museum, which, you know, the magic begins from the minute you get to the front door. You have no idea where you're going into. It looks like a men's clothing store. It's great. But to just see to have David meet us personally at the beginning and guide the tour, and as he is the master of emotional hooks, he didn't let us down. He began with his childhood, and when the lights and the music swelled in for the imagery of Tannen's magic shop, the entire magic shop appears behind him. It just set the hook for your childhood. And, you know, he admitted that's why we're all doing this, is to try to relive our childhood. So it was so nice to see that and to see every era of magic. I mean, Robert Houdin's automatons are there, you know, things from the 1500s that still work, whereas my washing machine does not. So it was just phenomenal to see the number of props. Every prop that I've ever seen in any catalog is there. In age groups, you know, the golden age of magic, and the fellows I grew up with in the 60s on television, Mark Wilson, and such a tribute to each individual performer with their props, their costumes. And I've got to say, I knew this building was probably going to be done right. I was hoping it was done right. Oh, my word. It is a world-class museum and library.
Yeah, the Smithsonian had come through, they said, and apparently the people said, this is the best private collection we've ever seen. Not just the items, but the way it is displayed.
Yes.
And the lighting and everything.
Yes. He did not let me down. I'm kind of a tech guy anyway, and I was like, boy, I hope they've got fire suppression and lighting and atmosphere and humidity. And it is. It is incredible. It's a world-class museum. I only hope and pray that I have an excuse to get to come back and see it, because to just spend 90 minutes there was definitely going down the buffet line and just seeing a little piece of each. If you wanted to come back and just work the dessert bar, or in other words, the Houdini section, it would take weeks.
Yeah.
It's that
in
depth.
And the library, too, with, what did they say, 20,000 pieces or something?
And they're cataloging and indexing everything and grouping it together. You know, it's a full-time job, and it's a living, breathing animal. It's not done. It'll probably never be done.
Right.
You know, in things just come in and get categorized and put into the right places. And I can only imagine if I were a historian or an author and I needed to research something, it's all there.
And I like the way they brought us all through, and they had a certain time. They said there were 12 groups of 15, I believe, each. And they said if we delayed by 1 minute, it would back it up like, you know, several hours because of, you know, so they had to really keep on a timetable. So there really wasn't a time for a lot of asking of questions and certainly autographs or anything like that. Yeah. But, yeah, when you started with Copperfield and then he handed it off into the next room with Jim Rollins, he was showing us all these props, and then going into Martinka's, handing it off then to Stan Allen, I believe it was. Or no, was it Mike Caveney first? I think it was Stan. And
Caveney did the golden era. Stan did the era, like the 60s. Here's the magicians we grew up with and we knew.
Yeah.
And then we worked our way into the golden age with Caveney in the magicians we've never known. We were too...
Fu Manchu and Chung Ling Su.
Yeah, we couldn't have met them in our lifetime.
Right.
So.
Right. And then upstairs to the Houdini with a collection with Gabe Fiore talking about Houdini. And then from there to Chris Kenner with Robert Houdin. And then to Will Bradshaw, who took us into the museum where they keep all of the books, the 20,000 books.
Yeah, just absolutely phenomenal. I've been in magic 45 plus years, and was too busy trying to perform magic to really become a collector. Plus, I couldn't afford it. But to go there and just to be able to see that guys are able to house this, the guys who spoke and led the tours were like the guy to have talk
right
about
guy.
That section of the museum, and just a once in a lifetime experience.
Yeah. That was amazing. Well, good. Thanks for your reflections on that. I know a lot of people are envious of us who had an opportunity to go through this. Again, that's for many is a lifetime bucket list kind of a thing.
I'm still trying to explain it to my wife. I hope she gets it one day.
I tried to talk about this one time to a group, a luncheon group. You know, there was a fraternal organization that was not affiliated with magic at all. And I was, because I had spent some time, I'd spent a few hours going through this with David some years ago, and it was really cool, and I tried to explain my excitement, but I just couldn't pass, people don't understand what we have seen.
No. There were times where we were definitely described as nerds, and we understand that, and the real world, the muggles probably see us as that, but...
Yeah.
Man, what a holy grail moment it is. If you've studied magic or the art of magic in any way over your lifetime, this is a must. Somehow you've got to get here.
It was a good walkthrough so people could mentally kind of get that. Thanks, Terry, very much. Appreciate your time. So for the Magic Word Podcast, I was Terry Mackelson. This is Scotty out. As we are hanging around and waiting for the dealers are closing over here, and we're going to soon be kicked out of the room. But before we do, I thought I would talk with someone else just to give you a little bit more insight and some content. Also, hey, Tim Wise, hey, Bizarro, good to see you guys. I'll be seeing you coming to Austin, is that right?
Yeah.
You're going to be for the TAOM. Want to say hi?
Hello.
That was Bizarro. He's local. He's a local boy here now. And Tim Wise was over there. But they were here right now, actually, with David Kay. That's why I was over here.
No. You have other friends. They're more important than me. I'm not insulted.
So you came all the way from New York. So what is it like right now in New York as far as the masking or no mask or what, as far as restaurants and social distancing?
Yeah, they just now put a law in place that anything indoors, you have to be masked. Restaurants, gyms... Oh, no, sorry, I apologize. Masked and vaxxed. You have to prove that you were vaccinated to get into any indoor restaurant, gym, movie theater, theatrical experience.
You have to bring a piece of paper or something.
Yeah. Well, in New York State, they have something online that you fill out. It jumps into their computer. Their computer confirms that you got it, and then you get a little... a QR code.
Yeah.
And that's proves. So then that gets scanned when you walk in a door.
Right.
They scan that and that proves that you've been vaxxed.
So we're here at a collector's meeting, and you have in the past, I know, talked about some old-time things that are kid show props and things from collectors. And you've been a speaker at this in the past, or it seems like I've heard you talk at some other convention about this.
No, I've never spoken at a collector's convention. But I talked about the history of children's magic at a few other, like, general magic conventions.
Yeah.
Particularly, the first time I did it was at an IBM-SAM combined convention.
Well, while we were at the collector's convention, why don't you just give us just a quick synopsis? I mean, when was and who was the first person who did kids' magic?
The first kids' magic was performed in America by the clergy, by ministers who used magic to help teach the gospel. Woolston was the man's name.
And what year?
1910.
Okay. Wow. Wasn't that long ago.
No, that's exactly right. That's why the name of my talk is The First 100 Years of Children's Magic, because it is only 100 years old. Then by the 20s, England started performing magic for kids. People in England started performing magic for kids. And there were a couple of small little pamphlets written about magic for kids. But in the States, it was mostly... within the church through the 30s and 40s in England it was mostly done it came out of Punch and Judy and pantomime, English pantomime, and that's where, so the English style of children's magic is very interactive, and the kids, because in pantomime the audience really, they have these phrases that the kids yell out, and the most famous is, "Oh no, I didn't." "Oh yes, you did." And the kids yell out, "Oh yes, you did." And then also the idea of something behind the main character that the main character doesn't see. That's big. That started in pantomime, and then it evolved into children's magic. So the children's magic in England started through pantomime, very interactive, lots of screaming, lots of yelling and activity. And the American children's magic developed through the church, which means it developed in a more preachy, educational, sort of academic way. So the kids in American children's magic weren't... they were mostly quiet and watching the magic rather than the English style where they were yelling and screaming. And
with the clergy that was doing this, though, I'm curious, were they actually doing what we will refer to today as gospel magic from the standpoint of having things that kind of would preach the gospel or, say, you know, have a Jesus scarf or something kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, really? Back
oh yeah.
Then, even.
Yeah. That, okay, but well. That's where it started in America was the... Was in ministers teaching the gospel using magic as examples.
I see.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Wow. Interesting. And so that takes us then, as I said, early in the 1900s or before that. I guess it was just street magic, or I should say stage magic. I mean, when you had, like, I don't know, Thurston and Keller and others who were involved in doing stage shows, and that was more for adults. It really wasn't for kids.
But we know that we know that there were magic shows for children on the weekends by stage magicians, mm-hmm. because on the posters it'll say kiddie show, not kiddie show, but magic show for the children, Saturday at 2 o'clock, what have you. But from what I understand, that show wasn't very different from the evening show. In fact, I talked to Adele, you know, the Blackstone's assistant, senior assistant, and about Blackstone's weekend show, because it very famously had a show for kids where he would give away the bunnies and stuff like that as opposed to the night show. But the afternoon show for the kids, she said, was exactly the same as the evening.
As far as the content
show.
And the illusions or whatever they did.
Yeah, exactly.
Huh.
Yeah.
Wow, that's interesting. Well, David, thank you very much. And I assume that you really enjoyed the museum today?
You assume that? That's a safe bet.
Yeah, that okay.
was. Yeah. That was. It was extraordinary.
Have you been there before?
No, it was my first time. So.
And? basically? I mean, when you saw tannins and the lights came up, did that bring tears to your
eyes? Oh, that's funny. That's a very theatrical moment. And
I was with Jamie and Swiss when that happened, and he just wept.
Yeah.
And Danny Orleans, too.
Yeah, well, Jamie, that shop is a replication of the 42nd Street tannins and not the 1540 Broadway tannins. I grew up with the 1540 Broadway tannins, and the 42nd Street tannins had closed somewhere, I think, within David's youth, and then they moved up to 1540 Broadway. Hmm. So, but that circular display cabinet that's in the center of the tannins shop here in Vegas. Was the counter on 42nd Street, not the one?
That was Macy's, though, wasn't it? I thought.
Oh no, that first cabinet was Macy's.
Yeah.
Right, but then there's a. But then when the lights come up, there's a circular wooden horseshoe-shaped cabinet in the center of the store, bigger.
Yes. Okay.
And that's from 42nd Street tannins. Mm-hmm. Whatever that's worth, but I never went to the 42nd Street tannins. My first tannins was 1540 Broadway, but it was way too short a tour because you could be there certainly all day.
They moved through or longer.
Yeah,
I talked to Paul Keeve and he said like 4 days. I think when he was here.
Yeah, absolutely. I visited Klosterman's collection and he and I stayed up till 4 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. We started at 10 a.m. and we didn't finish hanging out and looking at all the stuff until 4 o'clock the next morning. So yeah, look, people like us and people that come to this convention, we love the history of magic, and so clearly we could be there forever and ever.
I got to stay at Ken Klossman's house, thankfully, several times, and we'd go downstairs and he would show me different things. I remember the first time he showed me the light heavy chest, and. I said, just try and pick it up. And I said, I know what this is. And I said, I can't pick it up. He said, go ahead and try it. I said, no. And he said, try it. Okay. And it's like, oh, no, I'm going to hurt my back. You know? And so I said, no, really try it. And it's like, I know. And I
know.
And I did. And I can't, you know, obviously you can't.
Yeah.
And so they said, now try it. Okay, now you can lift it up. So when they were showing this today, you know, Chris Kenner said, well, here's a replica of this. And I said, so was that the Ken Klossman? He said, no, but that's coming up for auction, apparently, which is the original
Udon. That's correct. Yeah. That's right. And in my tour... someone asked the question about the light and heavy, the light and chest, and then Kenner said, so the answer was no, that's a replica, and then he said, but it won't be for long.
Yeah,
hinting
David's
at the Klosterman auction. Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
He said, yeah, it's coming up for bid.
Yeah. That thing is gonna.
How much do you think
music?
That's going to go for?
Oh,
I'm going to say that's got. I bet you over $50,000.
Yeah, I would say $100,000. Mm-hmm. I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be $100,000.
I mean, it's part of history.
Yeah, it's a huge part. It's a pivotal prop in the history of magic. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole thing with the African army and
uprising
all that stuff,
right?
So, yeah. I mean, it's one of these. It's not just another prop, and and plus all the props that belong to famous magicians have heightened value. And this is Robert Houdin, which makes it even more important. Plus its place in history makes it very important. Yes, I'm saying $100,000.
Yeah. Okay.
At least let me just say that's my budget.
You're not going over that.
No, I wouldn't go over that. But don't.
Okay.
But
so David knows what the starting price is.
Yes, the starting price. Exactly. That is the starting price of that thing.
That's good. Thank you very much.
All right, Scott.
So that was my buddy David Kay from way back. You know, I started this 10 years ago, and that was after Dot Vickers had kicked me out of the nest, basically, when you and I were doing this for the Magic Newswire.
Yeah.
And, man, we've been friends for so long.
Yes.
And not long enough. I hope we're friends for
absolutely
eternity.
We will be.
So the Magic Word Podcast. My buddy David Kay, Silly Billy, Scotty out.
That's nice.